here are the classes that I'm taking. And one of those classes that I was enrolled in was a survey of the Old Testament with professor you've heard me talk about several times named Dan Dyke. And the friend I called, his name was Josh. Josh said, I took a class with Dan once. In the very first class I took with him, he begins every class with prayer. And I'll never forget the first day of class, he asked everybody to join him in prayer. And I was afraid to open my eyes because I could feel the presence of God in the room when he prayed. And that kind of piqued my interest. And then he said, you know, you'll probably love the class so much you'll want to take every class that he offers from this point on. And he was right. I did that. I think I remember telling Barbara, like, any class that he offers, whether it's something I'm interested in or not, I want to take it. And the last class that I got to take from Dan Dyke was my last semester in seminary, and it was basically a class on the theology of suffering. And the class was based on the books of Job and Lamentations. And we spent the majority of our time in the book of Job. And interestingly, one of the biggest things that I took away from this class on the theology of suffering revolved around the presence of God. Now, there was a lot to digest from the book of Job, but there's one big thing that I'll never forget from this book. It was like when I got to this point and when we were studying the last part of this book, this just jumped out at me and it was so profound. That God's presence in Job's pain led Job to a more intimate relationship with God. So if you're familiar with the book of Job, it's a book of suffering, but the book begins by talking about this man, Job, who's righteous. And so his suffering really isn't a result of unrighteousness. It's just that he's living life, and life sometimes is full of suffering. And he goes through this ordeal of losing everything, but it's near the end of the book, after all of the heartache, all of the pain, all of the loss, but prior to his restoration. So at the end of the book, spoiler alert if you haven't read it yet, you know, Job gets restored and he gets a lot of stuff back. But this statement that he makes happens before the restoration. It's after all the pain, but before the restoration. In chapter 42, verse 5, Job said this. He said, my ears, and he's speaking of God. He said, my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. And this is a shift that Job made in his life. It was a shift from simply knowing God to being, but there are also parts of it that are skipped over regularly. And it's like we pick and choose pieces of it. The ones that sound good, we'll quote those all the time and we know them. But the parts of it that are troubling, we kind of gloss over. Now, this Psalm 139, it's attributed to David. David's the author. And really what I see when I look at this psalm is it wrestles with the complexity of God's presence and how God's presence impacts us as individuals, as people. So I want you to flip to Psalm 139. As you're turning over there, I'm going to kind of give you some background information on the collection of the book of Psalms. And also just a reminder, there's a YouVersion Bible app event out there that'll help you follow along. I'm not sure how close I'm going to stick to my notes today, though, just a heads up. So the context of the book of Psalms as a whole is arranged to tell a story from beginning to end. The collection of Psalms as a whole retell the story of the Old Testament. You know, last week, a few weeks ago, we talked about the structure of Matthew and how Matthew was structured into five parts to kind of mimic the five books of the law, the Torah. The Psalm is similar. We'll get to that in a minute. But the collection of Psalms, the writings, all 150, were very important pieces of literature during the period of exile for the Jewish people. So the period of exile is after they've gone into the promised land And the Assyrians have come in, the Babylonians have come in, and they've carried off a lot of the Jewish people away from the promised land. So they're away from the temple and trying to live out their faith in a foreign land. So this collection of Psalms is essentially a collection of poetic prayers that become a literary temple. Okay, so think about this for a moment. The temple was extremely important in Judaism because the temple was where the presence of God resided. And so in their mind, if we don't have access to the temple, we don't necessarily have access to the presence of God. And so Jerusalem is the place where the physical temple was. Now we're in exile. We can't get to the physical temple. And what the collection of Psalms become is they become the place where God could meet with them. It's broken into five main sections, which I think is fascinating. You know, I think five sections probably points to that Old Testament theme of the five books of the law. There's an introduction. The first two chapters comprise the introduction. They're, most of your Bibles will probably recognize there's book one, book two, book three, book four, book five of the Psalms. So books one and two are all about David and his family. Book three is about the tragedy of exile and the downfall of David's lineage. And then books four and five are about a new hope for God's kingdom and the Messiah after the exile. And then we get a five-part conclusion of praise to God for his faithfulness. That's the overall structure of the book. Psalm 139 falls into the fifth section of the collection of these psalms. So, and that's the psalm we're going to look at very in depth today. So keep that in mind. We're in the fifth section, and it's all about new hope for God's kingdom and the Messiah, the reality of the Messiah after exile. I was going to read the entire psalm together, but I think I'm going to skip over that. We'll just read through the sections of it together. But before we get into how I'm going to break this up, you know, there are three areas often, if you do a Google search on Psalm 139 and you're looking for theological stuff, almost the top five things that pop up, our preachers are going to preach a specific way about this psalm, okay? So there's three big theological concepts that we can gather from Psalm 139. The first of that we see in verses 1 through 6, and it's all about God's omniscience. Now, I know that's probably a word that some of you aren't familiar with, but if you ever decide to go to seminary one day, this will be an important word for you to write down, omniscience. And really, all it means is that God is all-knowing. He knows all things, okay? And then you get to verses 7 through 12, and a lot of preachers will say, this is all about God's omnipresence, which means he's present everywhere. So we have his all-knowing, his all-presence. And then verses 13 through 18 is about his omnipotence, which just means that he's all-powerful. And so we'll take this psalm and we'll break it up and we'll say, look, here's three ways we can identify God's essence, some of his character in these three areas. But all three of these concepts that we see that are pulled out of this are about knowing God. You know, if you want to know God, you have to understand he's all-knowing. He's ever-present. He's all-powerful. But what's interesting to me is the psalmist takes these ideas, these concepts about God, and he makes them personal. So he takes it out of the construct of just knowing about God and having like a head knowledge. He takes it to a deeper level. So let's look at the first six verses together. And you'll be, some of you will be familiar with these six verses. It says, you have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Now, you know, one of the reasons preachers and maybe seminary professors, put a lot of emphasis on these concepts of God is because within Christianity, we stress, we emphasize the importance of knowing God. It's an important piece of Christianity. But what we see here David doing is taking these big theological doctrines and applying it to his own life. You know, now that I know this about God, what does it mean for me? And essentially what David comes to in these first six verses is that if God is all-knowing, then God knows me. And there are some words that clue us into the depths of God's knowledge. Because if you read through those six verses, in verse one alone, there are two different words in the Hebrew used to describe knowledge. The first thing David says is, "You have searched me." And the word hakar means thoroughly examined. You have thoroughly examined me. And then he says, "You yada me," which means you know me intimately. And this Hebrew word yada is a word that's used for intimate knowledge. And a lot of times it's used in the context of how a husband and wife know each other. And then you get to verse 2, and he throws in another word that means discern or perceive, or you have considered me. And then in verse 3, we get two more different words, which it says in some translations, you discern, but really it means like you winnow, you scatter, you sift my way, or you're familiar, accustomed to. And he goes back to that yada, you know it completely. And then at the end, he summarizes it all with a different word, da'at, which means understanding, wisdom. So in six verses, we have six different words referring to the knowledge of God concerning David as an individual. And so the level of being known by God is a lot deeper than God just being acquainted with us. God knows each of us deeply. So that's what David gets to here. And when we understand that God knows us very intimately, very deeply, it invokes a couple different responses. If we're honest, and I think David, what we see here in just a moment, is David wrestles with these two different responses. Because when we understand that we are known fully by God, it can either be comforting or it can be conflicting. And as we go through the rest of this psalm, this is what we see David kind of vacillating between these two responses of how comforting it is, but at the same time, how conflicting it is to be known intimately by God. And in reality, the response that we feel to being known by God in this intimate way is really dependent on the situations that we find ourselves in for the most part. It's comforting to know that God knows us intimately when we're navigating through difficult circumstances. You know, I think about times in my own life when I've dealt with loss or uncertainty. The idea that God knows me brings me comfort in those situations. And the psalmist also points out that God's knowledge of us includes our way of life, the path that we're on. He says that when we're active, essentially, when we're active and when we're resting, he knows. He knows what we're thinking even before we think it. God knows our hurt, he knows our pain. But God's intimate knowledge of us also includes that he knows our doubts and he knows our fears. He knows the questions that we have. He knows the unwholesome thoughts that we entertain. And I think this is the conflicting part of God's omniscience. To understand that God knows us, this is when it becomes conflicting to know that he really knows us. So if you're an individual that likes to write things down, here's one big thing I want you to take away this morning as you walk out those doors. and I think it'll help shape your overall relationship with God. It's this: we are fully known as individuals by an all-knowing God. And I think it's a perfectly normal response to this realization, at times to be comforted and also at times to be conflicted. So if you're like, man, that really makes me feel uncomfortable, that's normal. It should. It should make you uncomfortable. Because the psalmist, David, he gets uncomfortable. So write that down. We are fully known as individuals by an all-knowing God. And then write this down: the God who knows us intimately is present with us everywhere. And this is what we get in the next few verses. So if you pick back up at verse number 7, you'll find David writing this: where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light becomes night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. The God who knows us intimately is present with us everywhere. So when we think back to the overall structure of this collection of the book of Psalms, I think what the purpose, the intent of those people that collected these writings and put them together in a whole was that it makes God's presence personal wherever you find yourself. And so for these people that were in exile, these writings were arranged with the intent of leading people faithfully through God's story and helping them understand that even though they could not be present at the temple, they could experience God's presence right where they were. So these writings were designed to transport people into God's presence through these poetic prayers. Now, one of the things that's fascinating to me about this psalm is that we're reading a psalm of David, whose writing was put into this package, so to speak, for a group of people who were wrestling with the idea of not being in God's presence because they were away from the temple. But yet we have David writing about the significance of God's presence, who lived before the temple. So the temple wasn't built until after David died. Now, we know David had access to the tabernacle, but really, the interesting thing is David, this guy who lived before the temple, is helping people realize that God's presence isn't tied to the temple. God's presence is tied to wherever you are, wherever you find yourself in life. So it's not limited. God's presence is not limited to a place. And the picture we see David painting is that God's presence is all-encompassing. And he asks in response, you know, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? And then he uses what's called a merism to describe the presence of God. Now, a merism is a rhetorical device that contrasts two opposites to describe the whole. And I wanted to bring this out, especially because some of the discussions that we've been having on Sunday night revolve around one of these topics. So what David wrote is, if I go up to the heavens, you're there. Now take note of that, the heavens, way up high. If I make my bed in the depths. Now, the NIV has translated a word that sometimes doesn't get translated, and we've had discussions about this on Sunday evening. This is Sheol. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. And, you know, sometimes we get caught up in trying to understand these concepts of heaven and Sheol. We sang about it this morning. When we all get to heaven, what is heaven? We all want to know, what's heaven like? What's it going to be like? And then we have discussions about, well, what really is Sheol? You know, It's the place of the dead. It's the netherworld. Well, we want to know more about that. But the psalmist isn't really concerned with trying to discern what those two places are. What he is telling us is as far down as you can go and as high as you can go and everywhere in between, that's where God's presence is. That's the picture he's painting. And so when I read this poetically, what I see is in the highest points in my life, God's presence in there is there. In the lowest point in my life, God's presence is there. And every place, even the mundane, if I look hard enough, if I still myself to be quiet enough, God's presence is there. And so for David, God's presence is a reality no matter where he finds himself. He doesn't need to visit the tabernacle to experience God's presence. And the reassurance for these exiles reading this was that they didn't have to visit the temple to experience the presence of God in their life. And so today, our situation, our location does not dictate our access to God's presence. You know, believe it or not, we can experience God's presence just as much outside of these four walls as we can inside these four walls. We are fully known as individuals by an all-knowing God. The God who knows us intimately is present with us everywhere. And this third theological concept that David tackles is this omnipotence of God, the fact that God is all-powerful. He has unlimited power, unlimited ability. And David takes this concept of God being so powerful that it impacts him. Look at verse number 13. We'll read verses 13 through 18. Again, this is another section that's very familiar to a lot of people. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. David speaks of two acts of God on his behalf. And in the beginning of that section, it's the act of creating and the act of covering. So remember, this is poetic language, but what David says specifically when he says, you created my inmost being, is he says, God, you created my guts. That's the Hebrew. My innards. You created my innards and you covered my body. And he pushes this even further because he says, not only did you create me, everything inside of me and cover me, but you have fashioned my life. And the language that David used is related to a potter forming clay on a wheel. And so David's insight is that God has shaped and molded him as a being, as well as shaped and molded his way of life. And if we stop to think about just those two things, the fact that David makes this personal, and every one of us can make it personal, is that God has created our inmost being. He has fashioned our way of life. Just those two things in and of themselves are amazing. This all-powerful creator intimately forms and fashions our life. Creation is so complex, yet God is responsible for each of us individually. I mean, when you really stop and think about that, it's mind-blowing. But David doesn't stop there, and neither does God. David writes that God continues to think about. He continues to consider us. And the idea that this carries is that this consideration isn't just a here and there occurrence. It's not just, well, he considered us at creation, but it carries the idea that God considers him continually throughout his life. He says, God's thoughts of him outnumber the grains of sand. And so I want you to write this down. We are the product, our lives, our bodies, of an all-powerful God that thinks of us. Now, I want to pause here for just a moment before we get into this portion of the psalm that's oftentimes overlooked or skipped. Because I don't want to like miss how what we've covered applies to us. It's important to keep in our mind as we read these things, these thoughts of David, that David was not a perfect man. And I don't know why we do this, but for some reason we look at these characters in the Bible and we make almost all of them heroes, and we put them on this pedestal. And when we do that, we miss the significance of their story. So David was not a perfect man. When we impose this idea onto David, we actually do ourselves and him a disservice. And even more so, we do God a disservice when we do this. David fell short on more than one occasion in more than one way. You know, a lot of people say, oh yeah, David, you know, he was an adulterer. He had an adulterous relationship with Bathsheba. Yeah, he did. He was also a murderer, because to cover up his affair with Bathsheba, he killed her husband. And a lot of people say, yeah, we know those things. But David also did other things wrong. You know, David took a census of all the people when God told him not to do it, and then infuriated God. And you can read through there, and there's other things that David has done. Like, he's not the perfect person. But when we read a psalm like this and some of his other psalms, we realize something very important about David. And the fact that despite David was not a perfect person, his knowledge of God traveled from his head to his heart. And you know, one of the greatest difficulties in our life of faith is this one-foot journey from here to here. But David makes that. David makes this transition from just having a knowledge about who God is to experiencing who God is. And David, that experience that David had led him to understand that this God knows me in my imperfections, in my faults. And one of the things that we have to understand when we come to this psalm is that God desires the same for us. He does not want us to possess a simple head knowledge of who he is. Listen, I'll be the first to tell you, I love having theological conversations. I love talking about omniscience, omnipresence, and kind of fleshing out what that means. But God's desire for us is deeper than that, because God invites us into his very presence. And when we move away from simply knowing God to understand that we are known by God, that radically changes our faith. And I want to point out in the rest of this psalm two ways our faith changes when God's presence becomes real to us. And I'm going to let you write them down before we dive into them. There's two ways our faith changes when God's presence becomes real to us. First is that the tension between good and evil is experienced on a different level. When God's presence becomes real to us, that tension between what's good and what's evil takes on a whole different perspective. And the second thing is, we recognize that God knows us better than we know ourselves. All right, so let's look at the rest of this chapter together, verses 19 through 24. And really, when we get to, hopefully you'll notice, when we get to this section, it's like the psalm takes a turn here. It's different. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. We get to this section, and David's tone changes. David experiences this tension between those who are wicked and evil. But notice that the tension that David experiences because these individuals, it's not that because they're at odds with him. The tension that he feels is because they are at odds with God. And what I would say is that David sees these people as his enemies because they are enemies to God. Notice he doesn't say, I hate those who hate me. He says, I hate those who hate you. And these are difficult verses, especially when we realize that this is actually a prayer that David is praying. It's imprecatory in nature, which means that he is asking for God's judgment. Now, the important thing to note is that as David feels this tension between good and evil, David is asking God to do the judging and God to act. David's not saying, help me overcome my enemies. He's not saying, let me go to war. He's saying, you be the judge. You act. He puts it in God's court. And we live with this same tension. You know, we are going to experience individuals who are in active rebellion to God. And when we personally experience God's presence in a way that helps us to relate to him on a deeper level, that doesn't exempt us from these things. Just because we know God intimately and understand that he knows us deeply doesn't mean that we're not going to encounter evil. It doesn't mean that we're not going to encounter people that are opposed to him. But it does help us see these situations and see these people differently. And one of the things that it helps us see is that while our relationship with God is personal, we can't take these people, their evil, their acts, personal. It's not about us. David puts it in the perspective of, it's between you and them. It's not about me and them, it's you and them. And so when we encounter these situations in life where, man, we just don't think those people are living up to your standard, God, our prayer should be pretty simple. It's we ask God to intervene. We ask God to do something about it. We shouldn't take it upon ourselves to be the one to act. Now, the interesting thing here as David progresses through this is that his recognition of evil that surrounds him doesn't just lead him to ask God to judge the evil of the world. Because this isn't where David ends the psalm. David asked God to search him. That's where he ends. Why? Because David understood that God knew him better than he knew himself. And so what David is saying is, there are people, there are evil people out there, God, who hate you. And I would ask that you would intervene, that you would judge those people because they hate you. And then he gets to the point where he says, but I don't want to be numbered among the people who hate you, so search me and know me. Because David understands, you know me better than I know myself, and the things that I know about myself scare me. I know that I'm the guy that when I see a beautiful woman, I'm tempted to be in an adulterous relationship. I know that I'm the guy that's willing to kill her husband to cover that up. And so essentially, I think David knows that I can be one of those wicked, evil people. This situation, these verses are a beautiful illustration of Jesus' teaching regarding judgment found in Matthew chapter 7. What Jesus teaches in Matthew chapter 7 is that we need to examine ourselves before we examine other people. Jesus said, you must take the log out of your own eye before you try to remove the speck of dust from your brother's eye. And A.W. Tozer said this, he said, we can never know who or what we are till we know at least something of what God is. And so this Psalm of David shows us that understanding we are known by God is just as crucial to our faith as knowing God. Experiencing God's presence in this way will lead us to feeling both comforted and conflicted. I mean, this is where David is at. He's experiencing both of these. On the one hand, God's presence in times of trouble is a comforting thought, but on the other hand, God's knowledge of all of my shortcomings and sin can lead me to feel conflicted. And David wrestles with these emotions. He wrestles with God's intimate knowledge of himself. But I think the important thing that we need to understand and recognize is exactly where it is that David lands in this psalm. I think this is one of those things that's just building and building and building until it gets to the end, and notice how it ends. David does not run from God. David understands, he knows everything about me. It's a deep knowledge, and he doesn't run, he doesn't hide in fear. It ends with David inviting God to take a deeper look. And David experiences God's presence in such a way that he doesn't see God's infinite knowledge, his infinite presence, his infinite power as a threat. He sees it as an opportunity. And I think the question that we need to ask ourselves is, how do we reach that level of trust with God? How do we take these attributes of God and make them personal to us? I think it begins with understanding that the God that knows all the dirty details about our lives, he knew these prior to inviting us into a relationship with him through Jesus Christ. Paul wrote this in Romans chapter 5, verse 8. He said that God demonstrates his own love for us, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That word sinners is an interesting word. If you don't know, the Old Testament that we have was translated from some Hebrew text, but there's actually there's an Old Testament that existed prior to our Hebrew manuscripts in Greek. It's called the Septuagint, the LXX. And that translation was written because a lot of people were speaking Greek rather than Hebrew. And in the Greek Old Testament of Psalm 139, verse 19, it says, if only you would slay the wicked. Those writers chose the same word that Paul chose in Romans 5, 8. And so in the Greek Old Testament, David says, if only you would slay the wicked. It's harmatios is the word. And in Psalm 5 and 8, it says, but God demonstrates his own love for us that while we were still harmatios. And so Paul puts us all in that category of those wicked, evil people. You know, that troubled David so much. But Paul points out that God loves us so much, he demonstrates his love that while we were still those wicked, evil people, Christ died for us. See, what David teaches us is that God's presence becomes more of a reality in our lives, and that relationship with God becomes more personal when we practice a posture of surrender. This is where David ends this psalm's at. It's surrendering to God. He says, search me. Examine me. Know my heart. And this isn't the only time that David does this. I think what we see, the pattern of Scripture concerning David, is that David practices this surrender over and over and over again in his life. Psalm 51 is another perfect example. In that psalm, David says, God, create in me a clean heart. Renew a steadfast spirit within me. Surrender is the way our relationship with God begins. And it's the way our relationship with God deepens. We have to surrender our life at the foot of the cross, and we have to continually surrender to God to allow him to lead us into the way everlasting. And that's how David ends his psalm. He says, search me. Know my heart. Test me in my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. How can you make it more personal? Let's pray. Continue to lead us into a way that you've already formed and fashioned for us. I'm fully aware, Father, that there are probably people in this room that have never completely understood what it means to surrender. I know that there are people who have a head knowledge of you, but still lack a heart knowledge. God, and I know personally how hard it is to make that leap from my head to my heart. But I pray that your Spirit would continue to move in those lives. And that we would all understand on a deeper level that being known by you is far more powerful, far more transformative to us than simply acknowledging who you are. Thank you for loving us so much, despite our faults, despite our failures, that you made a way for us to come back into a right relationship with you through Jesus Christ. And through this season that we call Lent, the season of preparation, I ask that you would help us to dig deeper, experience more of who you are as we ready ourselves to celebrate the resurrection. And it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Worship team's going to come forward. I'm going to encourage you to take some time to reflect as they sing this song. Maybe ask some of the questions that David asked in this psalm today. Ask God to search you. Ask God to know you. And rest assured that even in the searching, despite what he finds, he still loves you.